welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFBRL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest this week is Nigel Gould-Davies, the Senior Fellow for Russia and Eurasia at the International Institute for Strategic Studies and author of Tectonic Politics, Global Political Risk in an Age of Transformation, published in 2019. Nigel's great expertise, particularly on the region that is the subject of this podcast, comes in part from his experience as a diplomat. He was the British ambassador to Belarus from 2007 to 2009, and he's also been the head of the economics section at the British Embassy in Moscow. Thank you very much for joining me today, Nigel.
Hello, Steve. Can you hear me? I'm just saying it's a great pleasure to be back on your program.
Yes, I can. Thanks very much, Nigel, and apologies to you and to the listeners for the technical problem. So, and thanks a lot for joining us. So it's great to have you. Now, the first thing I'd like to discuss is what's going on in the war in Ukraine. There's been fierce fighting in the Donbass in the east for weeks now, or even months, but there's also a lot of attention on southern Ukraine, in particular around Kherson, where Ukrainian forces have taken back some territory and may soon launch a major counteroffensive. Now, Russian forces still hold much of the Kherson Oblast or region, including the city of Kherson, which they seized not long after the unprovoked invasion of Ukraine on February 24th. It's the biggest city that the Russians hold outside the Donbass, where they control Donetsk, Luhansk, and Mariupol, which they occupied after virtually destroying it with missiles, bombs, and shells and killing thousands of peaceful civilians or more. Russia also controls parts of the Zaporizhia Oblast, but not the main city. And control over these regions gives Russia a so-called land bridge along the Azov Sea coast from the Russian border through the Donbass and up to the Crimean Peninsula. At the same time, Russian officials, including Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, have made it clear that Moscow intends or wants to control the Kherson and Zaporizhia regions in their entirety forever. And Moscow may seek to stage referendums this year, part of efforts to cement Russian control over these areas. And in fact, I believe today the Russian-installed putative head of the Zaporizhia region announced or ordered that there be a referendum on joining Russia. So that's a development directly in that direction. Nigel, what do you think Russia's next steps may be in the war, and how important is what may soon be an escalating battle for much of southern Ukraine?
Yes. So we'll get to what Russia may do in respect of annexation in a moment. That issue you just touched upon. It is very important. But let's, I think, start by casting the net sort of a little more widely than that and look at what Russia is doing in the round and might aspire to. And there are several domains to think about, military, political, and diplomatic as well. And let's go back briefly and remind ourselves that although, at least in my view, the outbreak of the war and Russia's invasion was to be expected, I thought that from as early as last November this was going to happen. The course of the war, at least for a period, has been unpredictable. So the invasion predictable, but the course of events much less so. And let's recall, initially, of course, it was this rapid attack along five axes to Kiev. The first surprise that failed and was pushed back, and then a new narrative took hold. This is Ukraine's counteroffensive, very quickly pushing back those many, at least, of those early gains. And then for the past couple of months, maybe a little more, there's been something much more closely resembling a war of attrition, slow, grinding, costly, large uses of artillery, small and limited gains. Those gains have enabled Russia to gain control, at least for now, over all of Luhansk region. But now, I think, as you drew attention to, the most significant potential near-term military development is a Ukrainian counteroffensive to retake Kherson. And Russia knows that and is preparing its defenses accordingly. So this is something that Russia, in effect, will be reacting to. They no longer, in this regard, have the initiative. They are reacting. That's something that no leader likes to do. They like to be in control of events. And I think it's fair to say that Putin has a particular aversion to reacting to events. Part of his modus operandi over many years has been making sudden, sometimes dramatic and unexpected moves that disconcert others and to which others have to respond, to keep others off balance and surprise them. And now he's much less in that position. He may try to regain the initiative in some degree. We should think about lateral moves and unpredictable things, always sort of think imaginatively when we're trying to anticipate Russia. There are a number of escalation options that they could attempt. A very significant escalation of air power is among them. We've also seen a calculated portrayal by the Russians of their risk acceptance, and even their, maybe a better way to put it, would be recklessness in the actions that they're taking, they're conducting around the Zaporizhia nuclear power station. Extremely dangerous, reckless, risky, and irresponsible. And I don't think that's really about trying to take control of any particular part of that territory. It's much more about signaling a recklessness that they want to disconcert Ukraine and its Western supporters with calculated or maybe less than calculated irresponsibility. We've also seen some diplomatic initiatives, of course, and more may follow. The most significant is, I think, the deepening relationship with Turkey. We've seen the two meetings with Erdogan in quick succession. There's something complex and interesting going on with that bilateral relationship. And then, of course, the grain shipments, which now finally appear to have begun as a consequence, in particular, of that first meeting in Tehran. Incidentally, just draw attention to the fact that one of the most interesting aspects of that second meeting in Sochi was apparently Ramzan Kadyrov was present, at least in Sochi, maybe not at the bilateral meeting between the two leaders, but given Kadyrov's role in this war and the prominence and visibility, if not necessarily military effectiveness of the Chechen forces, I do think that is interesting him to sort of pop up like that. But yes, I think in terms of finally on the political front, watch Russia's apparent preparations to annex areas it currently controls beyond Crimea itself. So a repetition and expansion, enlargement of the Crimean precedent, a fake referendum. There are even reports now that might be conducted online. So all pretense of any kind of normal process, not that the Crimean one was normal, of course, would disappear entirely. And all sorts of signs that this could happen really within the next month or month and a half, sometime before the end of September. Steady efforts, accumulating efforts on the part of Russia to try to establish an infrastructure of domination, making the use of the Hryvnia illegal, making it impossible for Ukrainian phone networks to function, and possibly most sinister of all, the imposition of new educational curricula and textbooks on these occupied regimes. Why would Russia do this? Why would it try to annex these territories? Especially ahead of a Ukrainian counteroffensive. I think that the part of this is you know, very important politically. If Russia annexes these territories, it will assert that these are now parts of sovereign Russian territory, and that therefore any attempt to liberate them on the part of Ukraine would ipso facto be an attack on Russian territory. Now, it's unlikely that any other country in the world would recognize that Russian claim, possibly Syria, possibly one or two others, but it would be unrecognized by the international community. Yet Russia would try to frame any future Ukrainian offensive in those terms, an attack on Russian sovereign territory, and therefore claim the right potentially to respond with much more serious means. So this could risk some form of escalation. So I think it's very, very important at this point that the West be politically and diplomatically ready to respond vigorously to any unfounded, unjustified claim of this kind by Russia.
Thank you very much for that. The idea of kind of signaling recklessness is pretty startling, I think, but it does seem to be exactly what they're doing. And I think Kadyrov is one of the people who's used or uses himself for that. So that's quite an interesting sign. I'd also just say one thing I'd like to sort of ask you about, though, is, and I agree entirely that Putin loves to do things, to take actions that are unexpected and surprising and catch others off guard. In this case, and you mentioned, you know, the idea that he'd rather not be kind of reacting. But on the other hand, I've heard, and I really don't know much about this, but isn't it in some cases more difficult for the side that is on the offensive, in other words, seeking to take back territory, than the side that is on the defensive, as Ukraine has been through in most of the time in this war?
I think it's important to make a distinction between offense and defense on the one hand, and aggression and liberation on the other. So to aggress, to take the offensive on foreign territory, as Russia tried to do in February, is more difficult than defending our own territory, as the Ukrainians have done since February, but it's also more difficult than liberating your own territory. So, of course, Ukraine would not be aggressing in a counter-offensive to free Kherson or any other part of its territory. It would be seeking to regain territory and liberate a population that is fundamentally sympathetic to it. One of the reasons why, among many, must be said, why Russia failed in its primary objectives in February was that it was attacking a population that did not want to be attacked. So yes, it's a counteroffensive that Ukraine is preparing for, and yes, Russia is preparing for that and digging in accordingly and developing its defenses and so on. But it's important, I think, to remember that it does not enjoy a sympathetic population in that territories in those territories when it's trying to do these things.
All right, thanks. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for that explanation. That tells me a lot that I didn't understand, I think. Now, you mentioned the idea that at this juncture, this kind of very important time for the West to be on its toes. So I just wanted to ask you something in connection with that. Last time you were a guest on this podcast in May, we discussed an article you had published in the New York Times, in which you wrote, among other things, that at a minimum, Western policy should ensure that Russia gains no new Ukrainian territory and continues to face severe sanctions until it fundamentally changes its policy toward Ukraine, unquote. In terms of the first of those two imperatives, almost 3 months later, I just want to ask how things are looking Is the West on its way to helping Ukraine ensure that Russia gains no new territory, or does it seem to be failing in that regard?
Well, I think that a key part of this question is how united and resolute the West is and is likely to remain. There is very unlikely to be an early outcome and settlement of this war. It's going to go on its many fronts for a long period. So ever since, almost ever since the war broke out, you had this extraordinary strong and united Western response across states, across civil societies, and across the private sector as well. Unprecedented degree of unity. Ever since that sort of sudden coalition and support of Ukraine emerged, people have been posing the question, well, how much longer can it last? And pointing to this bit of evidence and that bit of evidence and this speech and that speech for evidence of wobbles or cracks or some tendency for that coalition to weaken in some critical way. And I certainly think that's something that Putin is hoping for as well. But it seems to me that if one focuses on deeds rather than words, one has to remain impressed by the extent of Western resolve. We've now had seven packages of sanctions. We've had more rather than fewer heavy weapons being sent to Ukraine, including even from Germany. So in those respects, we're in a different world, even from what we were in February or March after the invasion began. And in terms of sort of concrete developments, those Western heavy weapons, the American HIMARS systems in particular, and other systems like it, are close to becoming something like a game changer. That anybody resort too easily to that overused cliche, but they clearly have had quick and significant effects. And to make an analogy with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, recall the significant difference that the Stingers provided to the Mujahideen. Had in the course of that war, not decisive, but significant. Maybe there's a way of just thinking about the HIMARS and other such systems as the stingers of this conflict. It's worth thinking about. The sanctions, as I say, have been escalating and are having effects, real effects and financial effects. There's a lot of focusing on sanctions utility. There's a lot of early focus on sort of financial indicators like the ruble exchange rate and the current account surplus, and people for those reasons say, well, look, they're not really having much impact, these sanctions. Firstly, I don't think that those financial indicators, which are useful in normal times if you're looking for the effects to assess the severity of a normal kind of economic shock, on an economy. I don't think they are anything like as useful when the shock is, as it were, politically imposed by sanctions. Look instead at real effects, what is happening to actual manufacturing sectors. And I think there's a lot of data, a lot of evidence coming in that those are doing the corrosive and cumulative damage that will get worse. But even the financial story itself, I think, is becoming more difficult now, and the story, the argument, the kind of sanctions skeptical argument a few months ago that, well, look, all these hydrocarbon revenues are surging and Russia is stronger than ever. Even that part of the story is weakening now. Russia's hydrocarbon revenues are something like monthly revenues are halved since April. So I think if you look at the deeds that the West is carrying out, both on the military front, as it were, and on the economic home front, I think we can be impressed. Not that we should be complacent, but it seems to me that's encouraging. But to go back to an earlier theme of this conversation, I think it is very important if Russia does try to assert a fundamental change of political facts on the ground and claim new areas as sovereign Russian territory. There must be no appetite, no inclination whatsoever to say, okay, well, let's try to sort of settle the conflict and let Russia have a bit more territory. That is no solution at all. In the best case, it could lead to a ceasefire. It would certainly not lead to the end of the war writ large, because I see no evidence whatsoever that Putin has scaled back his fundamental long-term objectives for this war.
Meaning to essentially subjugate Ukraine.
Absolutely right. The language of denazification and demilitarization has not waned, and Putin and a number of people around him or close to him have in terms reiterated that. They simply say it will take longer, but they've never disavowed these goals. And in a sense, on the contrary, as this war has gone on, the domestic framing in Russia of the war and what's at stake has escalated to existential levels, defined this in effect as part of a fundamental long-term struggle with the West. That's very much how this is seen. Not only even a conflict with Ukraine anymore, but something of global magnitude. So, I see, again, no signs that that anything short of achieving the full subordination of Ukraine would satisfy Putin. And even that wouldn't satisfy his ultimate ambitions, it seems to me.
That's and I'd agree. I mean, Putin has made remarks quite recently that have, you know, indicated that it goes beyond Ukraine and that he's framing it, as you said, as this kind of an existential battle with the West. And he hasn't hidden that. I think great points about the idea that Russia's trying to kind of create facts on the ground. I think, you know, just from conversations with kind of people in the West who are not, you know, may not be paying that much attention, they aren't focused on the region. I think some people sort of wonder, say, well, let's settle it. Let's they can keep the Donbass, you know, whatever. And now I think part of what Russia is trying to do with Kherson and Zaporizhia is to just move the borders of that kind of concept of where, okay, now let's let them have this. But as you say, you know, this is something that is not going to, accepting that is something that presumably is not going to resolve anything. So I think you've explained very well why this kind of phase of the war is so important. I'd like to move on, you know, both in terms of what's happening on the ground and what's happening in the West and the resolve. I'd like to move on to Belarus and hear your expertise on that country today. Now, tomorrow, August 9th, will be 2 years since the 2020 presidential election. Alexander Lukashenko, in power in Belarus since 1994, claimed a landslide victory and his sixth term, I believe. But there was widespread evidence of fraud. And Belarusians who had turned out for massive campaign rallies in support of his main rival, Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya, hit the streets for peaceful protests over a vote that they said was clearly and brazenly stolen by Lukashenko. In a podcast series that RFURL's Belarus service has created to mark the anniversary, Tsikhanouskaya recalls those days and says that for a while before the election itself, there was a kind of euphoria, and quote, it seemed to us that we had already won. And I would say that for at least a few days after the election, it seemed to me and many others, I think, that the opposition had won or was about to win, that Lukashenko would not remain in power for long and he'd have to go. But that did not happen. He countered the protests with a brutal crackdown, and 2 years later, he's still in power. And many of those who protested are in jail or have left Belarus, essentially forced out. Now, Nigel, this is a broad question, but what's your main takeaway from what we saw in Belarus in Belarus 2 years ago and what we're seeing now? And how big do you think Russia's role has been in the way things have developed? Moscow has certainly strengthened its influence over Minsk since August 2020, I would say. And Belarus hosted some of the Russian forces that rolled into Ukraine on February 24th and afterwards. But it has not sent its own forces to Ukraine.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. The elections 2 years ago were comprehensively falsified. There is absolutely zero doubt about that. The peaceful demonstrations that followed were in turn absolutely unprecedented and nationwide in nature. And yes, for a while it seemed there could be a fundamental change. Lukashenko had a Ceausescu moment, but there wasn't a Ceausescu outcome. So it seems to me that reflecting on the 2 years that have followed, there are a number of sort of lessons and implications. And not only for Belarus, but for authoritarian regimes more generally, including Russia. The first is that apparent stability in such a system can be an illusion. So Lukashenko clearly did not expect these events himself. An apparently fairly quiescent, fairly stable situation can suddenly erupt without, more or less without warning, at least without warning sufficient for the regime. So expect surprises. There is that that phrase, which I think is quite useful for situations like this. It takes longer than you think and then happens faster than you expect. The second lesson is that the hunger for freedom doesn't go away. Lukashenko had dominated the scene for a quarter of a century. He believed he controlled comprehensively Belarus and its information space and all the rest of it. And yet, in effect, you know, almost an entire sort of generation of his rule, the desire for change and especially for freedom, it doesn't go away. It can be suppressed for a time, but it's still there and it can persist and it can express itself in dramatic ways. A third lesson is that veteran autocrats can make mistakes, big mistakes. I think Lukashenko made a number of them. One might argue that the longer they're in power, the more likely they are to make mistakes because they get out of touch. They're surrounded by yes men. They are too confident in their own judgment. So, of course, these are all potential lessons for Russia itself. And one big question is, you know, what is the read across for what might follow in Putin's Russia? A rather different lesson, one that's more depressing in nature, perhaps, is that what we've seen after those nationwide peaceful demands for change erupted, their suppression and brutalization shows how isolated a ruthless regime can be and yet stay in power, at least for the short term. And because this regime, it seemed to me, had very, very few supporters and even fewer that were keenly or actively supportive of it. There are really two reasons for this, it seems to me. One is that there was no real elite defection. And I think a lesson of other times and places or changes like this is that that change when it happens comes from above as well as from below. It requires a critical mass of, as it were, the big people as well as the small people to take the view that the regime no longer serves their interests and that a different and better future is possible. And the second reason is that, of course, Belarus was helped by Russia in a number of ways, financially, in terms of the sending of so-called political technologists, other forms of support as well, with the controlling, reasserting control in a security sense, too. Of course, the Kremlin was taking notes, studying the situation in Belarus, drawing conclusions for itself as it faces the 2024 election, even as it was providing the support. So what are the implications for Russia? So it seems to me on those two points, elite defection and being helped by someone else. Now, of course, Russia can help Belarus, but there's no one really to help Russia, especially now that Russia is under very severe sanction. And there's no one that's going to play the role to Russia that Russia played in Belarus. So that part of the picture is different. And secondly, it seems to me that at least now, compared with Belarus, there is a greater degree of elite pluralism, or at least diversity, still within Russia. There are still groups of people that sort of matter. The system is not yet anything like as totally dominated by Putin as the Belarusian regime was dominated by Lukashenko. So if one draws attention to those two differences in Russia that compared to Belarus 2 years ago, then one might be at least less pessimistic that if it came to some major demand for change below, then it's at least possible we could see a better future in Russia than at least for the moment Belarus has seen in its own case. So there's a lot to think about in the comparisons that we draw attention to there.
Yeah, absolutely, a lot to think about, and I think you've helped help people frame it. You mentioned in the context of Belarus and Lukashenko the idea that autocrats make mistakes, and you mentioned the link to Russia, and I certainly thought immediately of, you know, Russia, and you know, has Putin, you know, a lot of people say Putin has made a huge mistake. And I guess we will be finding out how big, you know, how big those mistakes were, both in Belarus by Lukashenko and in Russia by Putin. So that will be something to watch, of course. We're getting short on time, but let's take a few questions if there are some questions from listeners. So you can request speaker privilege if you want to ask a question, or send a DM, or reply to the tweet, reply to the link in the tweet.
Hi, Martin, you can speak.
Thank you. Good morning from here in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. So The Economist had a very important discussion, by the way. Thank you so much. The Economist had an article, I think it was last week, which basically, long story short, said what many of us and many people around the world have been saying, it's certainly in the West, that Russia is now a fascist regime. So I guess picking up from that, and they're taking enormous losses in Ukraine, even by the minimum amount that have been estimated, you know, in terms of both manpower and equipment and the new weapons systems that the West, particularly the United States and Great Britain, have been supplying to Ukraine, e.g. the HIMARS, are effective. Extremely effective. So I'm just wondering, yes, this is the long game for the dictator in Russia, Putin, but how much longer can they sustain it with all of those losses that they are incurring, both in manpower and equipment? And let me just add before I ring off, and sorry for being so long-winded, the heroic resolve of the Ukrainian people and and I mean people, not just those in the military. And it is, I would say, a people's war, because the whole society is mobilized, but so many others who are involved, and those as well from the international community. So I'll go down to listen, and I'll just let you respond. And thank you so much.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. It raises the issue of the role of time in this war, and which side does time favor. So I've always seen this as a war being conducted on two fronts. One is on the ground with military means in Ukraine, and the other is on the home fronts of the respective participants by economic means. Now, on the ground, as you say, Russia has suffered heavy losses. It suffered very heavy losses early on in the war, and it suffered heavy losses in gaining control over Luhansk. And the variety of Russian sources now, as well as outside observers, but Russian sources too, which strikes me as really significant, drawing attention to the shortages in Russian manpower. The great problems now with the quantity and quality of infantry. And this imposes a real constraint on Putin, and he knows it, I think, but he faces difficult dilemmas in resolving it. What we've seen up to now is a series of barrels being scraped within Russia, looking for new sources of manpower that can be cajoled, persuaded, or paid to fight. And that includes taking people out of prisons, offering them the liberty in return for rudimentary weapons training and being sent to the front. They've taken people from deployed in South Ossetia and Abkhazia and Georgia, for example, even from the border, the Tajik border with Afghanistan. What they haven't yet done is order a general mobilization. They haven't yet called it a war, and they've not yet requiring, rather than, again, cajoling or persuading or bribing, people to fight. There is no comprehensive mobilization and mass conscription of the kind that there is in Ukraine. They haven't done that yet, and I think Putin knows that's a Rubicon it would be dangerous to cross. That is the real test of how popular this war will turn out to be in Russia. It's easy to support a war if you're sitting in a sofa watching the television. It's a very, very different matter if you or your husband or your son is being told they have to go and fight. So that manpower is a real constraint. And I think it's, you know, beginning to, it's coming close to biting now. And so Russia faces real problems. As I mentioned earlier, I think Russia faces escalating economic problems as well. It's not only a matter of the kind of diffuse pain that sanctions and Russia's really dramatically sort of growing isolation from the global economy will impose on the country as a whole, but specifically ways that might compromise its ability to produce new equipment. If you've got don't have access to high spec semiconductors, it's hard to make smart weapons, for example. In that, in those respects, time may not be on Russia's side. But I come back to this point that for the West, too, it's very important to focus on the role of time and therefore to remain unified and resolved and resolute. And of course, Russia, although in overall terms, drastically economically weaker, Russia is less than 3% of the global economy. Yet it has these weapons. And just going back to this question we started with, Steve, of what Russia might do next, of course, they are playing with the gas taps and putting the West, putting Europe on notice. They can turn those gas flows off completely. And I think they're banking more and more on that, on breaking the West's resolve by imposing economic costs on European populations. And as it's still very hot, of course, now it's high summer, August, but that will pass, of course, and the winter will approach. And I think that's what is Russia, perhaps as much as anything, is counting on now. Some turning off of the gas, forcing an abrupt shift or erosion of resolve in the West. So again, it's very, very important that the West prepare for that too. Because finally, and again, thinking once more about the role of time. If the West gets through a first winter without gas, it will be able to take the measures that will leave it better prepared to counter that weapon, to resist that pressure in any future winter. So this will be the first and the most difficult test. And if the West passes that test and is able to retain the political resolve to continue supporting Ukraine and resisting Russian aggression through this first winter, come what may, then I think things will look very difficult for Russia.
All right. Thanks very much for that. I also had wanted to ask whose side time was on. Thanks for the very comprehensive answer. And, you know, it does show that even more evidence that now is kind of a crucial time. And as we head into winter, Western resolve seems extremely important. And I guess that kind of ordinary people in the West are going to become more of a factor, perhaps than they have been so far. All right, I think we have time for another question, if there are any. Just give it a few more moments.
Hi, Patricia, you can speak.
Hello there. Hello from Montreal, Canada. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I have a quick question, and it's a little different from what you've been discussing so far, which has been fascinating. Thank you. I've been in Belarus a number of times, but the last time was 20 years ago, and I'm fascinated to read about so many, in particular, young Ukrainians, Russian-speaking, who are now switching to Ukrainian, both spoken and written Ukrainian. And I'm when I spent time in Belarus, there was almost nobody that spoke the Belarusian language. A few elderly people, as I say, this goes 20 years ago. The vast majority of the people were assimilated into Russian speaking, and of course, they represent only about a quarter of the population of Ukraine in terms of numbers. But I'm just wondering, since I've been a little out of touch with regards to Belarus, if there has been a similar revival at all of the language, culture, and identity, which of course always, you know, can always play an important role, and you know, in these moments of crisis. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a very, very good and thoughtful question. And just for a moment, drawing the analogy with Ukraine and Ukrainian. Of course, Ukrainian was always spoken much more widely than Belarusian in Belarus. And yet we've seen a kind of sort of catalytic effect since at least 2014, since the Russia's first invasion of Ukraine, many more people making the decision to either learn or to develop their Ukrainian in Ukraine itself. So the sense that this threat and the violence that Ukraine has suffered from Russia has been a kind of a catalyst of Ukrainian further development of Ukrainian identity. So in Belarus, yes. Yeah, so I remember a few years ago, certainly when I was there. I think one of the tests is whether people speak Belarusian in the home. And there's a proportion that speak both languages, Belarusian and Russian. But how many people speak as it were their default language? And it was the statistic at that point was, I think it was around 10 or 15%, something like that. So in practice, a minority. Further complicated by the fact that the purposeful speaking of Belarusian became a marker of oppositional commitment and activity. It was almost considered an oppositional sort of act to do that, to the extent that people even sort of risked arrest by doing so publicly on occasion, because the regime itself, the Lukashenko regime, was actively discouraged. Of course, Lukashenko himself does not really speak Belarusian much at all. And as Russia imposed non-military pressure, but sort of economic and political pressure, about sort of 10 or 15 years ago, including, I remember it when I was there, the regime began to kind of flirt with a so-called soft Belarusianization. You began to see and hear more officially permitted sort of uses of Belarusian, always, of course, you know, controlled and curated and within limits. But even on sort of television, used to see more Belarusian being used. So there has been that kind of mottled background. But I do believe now that, especially in, since the inspiring events and horrific response of the regime since the elections 2 years ago, these things are catalysts of Belarusian identity, much as oppression against Ukraine has been in that case too. So yes, watch it. It's a beautiful language, mm-hmm. by the way. So I don't know if you learned any or heard any while you were there, but it's a lovely thing. And yes, and in the best case, it will flourish as Ukrainian is.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the answer.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thanks a lot, and thanks for the question. We're almost running up against 1 hour, but I think we could take one more question if somebody has one. So I'll just give it a moment. Okay, I see you have a question that was sent, so I will ask that one on behalf of William. He says, we've seen a lot about Belarus getting involved. Do we know if Belarus has been asked and refused? In other words, getting involved in the war, directly in the war in Ukraine. Could they afford to get involved and still maintain domestic security?
Yeah. This is a very interesting question, of course. Belarus is de facto a co-belligerent because it has hosted attacks from its territory, of course, by Russian forces against Ukraine. But as far as we're aware, no formal use of Belarusian forces. There is, of course, a partisan Belarusian detachment fighting for Ukraine against Russia. It seems very likely that this is something that the Kremlin has pressed for. It's hard to get a precise fix on, but there are certainly rumors and reports of sort of known deep unhappiness within the Belarusian armed forces at the prospect of this. We know also, of course, that ordinary Belarusians have, at great risk to themselves, taken steps actively to hinder the movement of Russian forces within Belarus and into Ukraine, especially both by cyber means and also by physical means, complicating and diverting the movement of railway traffic. So I think that one of the reasons that Lukashenko will resist this as much as he feels it's possible for him to do without sort of jeopardizing his position is that, yes, he may worry about the implications for the loyalty of the Belarusian armed forces, or at least parts of them. It's hard to know exactly. But that will certainly be a relevant consideration. If one looks at the range of security forces used in the crackdown against Belarusians themselves, seems to me that the armed forces was used less than a whole range of domestic security forces. And the second reason is that Belarus would fall under even more severe Western sanctions if it were to escalate its status from a co-belligerent to a full military participant in the war. And those are two significant constraints, it seems to me.
Thanks very much for that, Nigel, and for the question. I'll just add, to me, it seemed in the 90s and 2000s, it always seemed like Lukashenko was saying, and people in Belarus were saying during Russia's wars in Chechnya, were saying, well, you know, at least we're not at war. And I think even, you know, some Russians looked to Belarus in a positive way because its government wasn't sending young men to war. So, you know, I think that's still probably a concern for Lukashenko, as he presumably continues to try to resist, if Russia's seeking, its involvement in terms of sending troops themselves. This is extremely interesting, but I'm going to cut it short here because we've been going for 1 hour. So I'm going to wrap it up. Nigel, thanks very much for joining us, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for joining.
All right. Great to have you, Nigel. And yes, thanks for the questions. Once again, I've been speaking to Nigel Gould-Davies, the Senior Fellow for Russia and Eurasia at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFURL. As I mentioned, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFURL podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'll be back next Monday for the next edition of The Week Ahead in Russia. And please have a look at my newsletter, The Week in Russia, on Friday. Thanks for listening.